You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vanderweel.
And I'm Ron Bronson. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, June 29th, 2017.
A lot of what hipness has meant over the decades is people reinventing themselves almost as if they're a character in a play.
Indiana University professor and author Phil Ford talks about the history of hipness on today's episode of Big Talk with Michael Glab. That's coming up later in the show.
Also coming up in the next half hour, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks local residents how they have been affected by the opioid crisis. But first, these local headlines.
A federal court has blocked some provisions of a new abortion law, Senate Enrolled Act 404, from taking effect. The American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana, on behalf of Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky, filed a lawsuit last month raising constitutional questions about the requirements imposed upon young women and health care providers by the law signed by Governor Eric Holcomb. Ken Falk, the legal director of the ACLU of Indiana, explains the provisions of the law that were blocked.
The court blocked the provision that would have allowed minors who were found to be mature enough to obtain abortions without consent to nevertheless have their parents notified. The court blocked the portion of the law that would have prohibited Planned Parenthood or anyone else from advising young women of their options other than staying in Indiana to get abortions. And the court blocked the provisions of the law that would have required Planned Parenthood and its doctors to not only get government-issued identification when parents or others, guardians, would consent to minor abortions, but also undetermined and vaguely defined other identification.
The law was set to go into effect on July 1st, and the ACLU had raised concerns about its effect on young women in the state.
The evidence was that many young women would have not even attempted to try and obtain a judicial permission to get an abortion if, in fact, their parents might be notified. And the idea that Planned Parenthood could not advise their patients that they could go to other states to get abortions, either because they had different requirements or longer periods of time that persons could get abortions, was a shocking violation of the First Amendment. And the vague identification requirements would have made it very difficult for Planned Parenthood and its doctors to know if they were violating the law and would have subjected them to all sorts of penalties based on vague and uncertain standards.
Falk said the provisions would also have effects on health care providers.
The law required in very vague and uncertain terms that certain identification be reviewed and actually be attested to by the doctor, and given the uncertainty, it would have put healthcare providers at jeopardy every time that they provided an abortion for a young woman whose parent or guardian consented.
In the press release, the ACLU says the court concluded this provision, quote, places an unjustifiable burden on mature minors in violation of the 14th Amendment, end quote.
I think the General Assembly has had a history of attempting to pass laws that would unconstitutionally restrict abortions, and obviously we felt this was a continuation of that pattern.
Betty Cockrum, the recently retired president and CEO of Planned Parenthood, Indiana and Kentucky, says that Judge Sarah Evans Barker's ruling is an affirmation of abortion rights in Indiana.
The Bloomington City Council has approved the development of pocket neighborhoods as a conditional use in single-family and core neighborhoods. Pocket neighborhoods and accessory dwelling units are the city's latest tactics aimed at providing an alternative to soaring housing costs. In the city council's meeting last night, Development Services Manager James Roach describes pocket neighborhoods as, quote, a cluster of affordable homes.
The idea of the pocket neighborhood is small, inclusive, clustered housing, clustered single-family homes around a common area, typically a common green area, but also could be common buildings, with reduced infrastructure cost because there are no streets built. It allows for shared resources, shared parking, shared common areas, and a greater sense of community.
Plans for each pocket neighborhood would first have to pass muster with the Bloomington Board of Zoning Appeals. During public comment, Bloomington resident Sandy Clothier questioned whether pocket neighborhoods are truly affordable, giving the planned Bloomington co-housing community as an example.
The Bloomington co-housing is currently looking at a cost between $250,000 and $350,000 per unit. So I do not consider most of these affordable. And I think that's one of the things that we need to look at. It's fine to say we want to develop these things, but let's not pretend that we're going to build affordable housing when housing is just very expensive to build.
Council President Susan Sandberg said pocket neighborhoods are not just about affordability.
It's about the building of communities. It's about sharing. And I know as a lot of people age, they want to be near other people that they can associate with, that they can have meaningful interactions with, and sharing spaces, sharing community buildings.
A proposal for a pilot project of accessory dwelling units is expected to draw more scrutiny than pocket neighborhoods. In describing the accessory units, Roach said they could be attached to an existing home or created as a standalone accessory apartment. He referred to the units as ADUs.
The proposal is to put a cap, no more than 30 ADUs approved anywhere in the city. And what that cap does is it gives us a moment to step back and think about the ordinance, think about how it's being implemented and how homeowners have been able to develop ADUs and how they have not been able to put an ADU in their backyard. What kind of challenges are they facing? What are the portions of the code that are working or are not working? And what are some of the unintended and unforeseen impacts?
Under the proposed rules, a homeowner would have to live in either the main unit or the accessory unit. Size would be restricted to 440 square feet for detached units and 600 feet for attached units. As the city approaches 30 accessory dwelling units, it would evaluate the pilot project and bring any potential changes to the plan through the Plan Commission. Early in the meeting, Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton appealed to the council to approve the program, saying a lack of affordable housing is causing members of the community pain on a weekly basis.
I believe that a pilot that does a limited number of these accessory dwelling units, very small in comparison to our housing stock in this community, that just lets us see what happens with 30 properties. Maybe nobody will do it. I don't know, but let's see what happens, because this, in my view, and many communities have tried this around the country, they are new to Bloomington, but many communities have done this, have seen accessory dwelling units as one piece of an effort to address affordability.
In considering the pilot project in their meeting last week, some council members expressed concern that the units will be used as student rental properties, especially in neighborhoods situated close to campus. Another concern is that some neighborhoods have covenants prohibiting the units, and those covenants would have to be addressed. The council postponed its discussion of accessory dwelling units to its September 6th meeting.
Bloomington Sanitation Services will operate their normal schedule on this July 4th. Trash, recycling, and yard waste should be on the curb for collection by 5 a.m. All city offices will be closed in observance of Independence Day. For more information, contact the Sanitation Department at 812-349-3443. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Ron Bronson.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. Support for WFHB and the Daily Local News come from Smithville Fiber, a local provider of internet, voice, and TV service. Now also offering home automation and security systems for homes and offices throughout South Central Indiana. More information on Smithville's home automation service is available online at smithvillesecurity.com.
Phil Ford is the author of Dig, Sound and Music in Hip Culture. He takes the reader on a tour of the cutting-edge world of jazz musicians, beat writers, and style arbiters who make up what it is to be hip. Ford is a professor of musicology at Indiana University's Jacobs School of Music. His interests range far beyond the narrow view of field of creating rhythmic harmonic sounds that are pleasing and not only to the human ear. Music ties countless disciplines together. Now he's working on a book to describe the magical thinking and how it relates to music and the greater world. He joins Michael Glab on this week's edition of Big Talk.
Hi, this is Big Talk. Michael Glab here. My guest in the studio today, Phil Ford. He's a blogger, an author, and a professor of musicology over at the Indiana University Jacobs School of Music. Thanks for being on the show, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Phil knows what is hip.
No, I know what people thought was hip like 70 years ago.
So what makes you an expert on this hipness?
The cynical answer would be because I wrote a book. The question was never what is hip, but I started off when I was going to work, and this is in the mid-late 90s, and I was living in Minneapolis, and I saw this kid with a goatee, and I started thinking, like, what is it about the goatee? That is part of the permanent rotation of styles. And, I mean, if you go back to the 50s and you look at all the kind of beatnik, beatsploitation, like the humor around the beat generation, you know, beats are always portrayed as having, like, a little goatee, right?
Right.
And goatee and sunglasses. And so I just started thinking, like, okay, so being a hip guy is supposed to be, like, you've got some kind of ineffable coolness. There's something unique. It's just you. And yet, we'd see people who clearly were not just expressing some kind of uniqueness. They're expressing a code of uniqueness.
A uniform.
Yeah, sort of. But with special rules, and it's really complicated. And as I started thinking it through, realizing how complicated it was, and also, you know, was relevant to the work I was doing at that time as a graduate student in musicology, that music seems to be implicated in this, because every musical subculture seems to have its own kind of hip style associated with it, or to put another way, every hip subculture seems to be like really involved in some kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that you can easily sort of say, like, okay, this is hip and this isn't. Although people have been publishing articles in newspapers since the 1940s saying what's hip and what's unhip. And what occurred to me was that I didn't want to ask that question. What I was interested in is thinking about hipness as an aesthetic, an idea of what is beautiful and what is meaningful and what is true in works of art, in pieces of music particularly, but also in individual human selves that are being conceived as works of art. That a lot of what hipness has meant over the decades is people reinventing themselves almost as if they're a character in a play. It has to do with a certain idea of the self. And a self in modern society, where you think of social existence as being like essentially, inherently unfree. And the job of the hipster is to act or not act, but to fashion him or herself in such a way as to resist that pervasive unfreedom. So how do you write about that which exceeds written expression? In a sense, that's like a koan or an unsolvable riddle.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can't solve it, and I don't think anybody can, at least I can write about how generations of writers and musicians, especially writers, spend a lot of time talking about people like Norman Mailer and the Beats in this book, how those writers tackled that question.
Like Richard Feynman, I like to get to first questions. What is musicology?
It is a word that I don't much care for. I always think musicology is the most pretentious possible name we could have given our line of work. I prefer to call it just saying music history, because, you know, art historians don't call themselves artologists. So musicology can cover the waterfront. It can be a lot of different things, but I suppose I would say, in a very general way, it's the academic rather than performance study of music. Or for a lot of people, it's the academic as well as performance study of music. A lot of us are performers, or at least semi-lapsed performers. Since publishing the book, I've also been working on a series of essays that I'm planning on putting together into a book at some point, that all deal with aspects of this world of pattern recognition, this way of encountering the world in a kind of way that it privileges the individual experience. And the way that manifests is in thinking a lot, particularly about magical styles of thinking. Magic as in, occult magic, as opposed to the sawing ladies in half kind of magic.
Yeah.
You know, magical thinking isn't usually a compliment, right? There's that Joan Didion book, The Year of Magic,
My Year of Magical Thinking,
which is, I think, implying, you know, magical thinking being this sort of like this weak and childish desire to imagine true what you wish to be true.
Often ascribed to women.
Yes.
Women's intuition.
That's right. It is very often gendered, and very often this highly cognitive style is considered more distinguished, more respectable, but also, I think, more manly and less disgracefully womanish.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book that I'm working on is actually tentatively titled Lilith and Adam. I think I need a good subtitle, maybe Lilith and Adam, a love story. There's an apocryphal story, the idea that Adam actually had a first wife before Eve named Lilith. Lilith left, and Eve is actually the second wife of Adam. And one day I started trying to put into words these different modes of functioning. These different cognitive modes can be frustratingly abstract. And so one day somebody had asked me to write a talk to give at a new music festival. And I was trying to put in words the difference in a kind of a more magical style of thinking, as opposed to the more cognitive and rationalist style of thinking.
Aristotelian way of looking at things, perhaps.
Yeah. The Platonic Aristotelian distinction is an interesting one to bring into this. Yeah. And I was trying to think of what's a really concrete way to break this down? And I started writing a story about Adam and his first wife, Lilith, and thinking of them as characters who personify these different ways of thinking. And the book started to take shape from there. And what interests me is the interplay between these different modes in music and musical culture, and how it plays across a variety of different musical contexts.
Phil Ford knows that music is much more than notes on a piece of paper or sounds that are hitting your ear. He talks about that at Indiana University. He's a professor of musicology there, also a blogger and an author. Phil, thanks so much for being on Big Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Support for WFHB comes from Monster Digital Marketing, offering digital marketing solutions for small businesses. Monster Digital Marketing websites are built for search engine optimization with both the desktop and the mobile device user in mind. Located at monsterdigitalmarketing.com or on the phone at 317-567-1197.
Support also comes from MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
And up next, our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
This week on Voices in the Street, have you been personally affected by the current opioid crisis? Last week, Bloomington police investigated a rash of overdoses, 10 of which occurred during a 24-hour period alone. As the opioid crisis rages on and its effects are felt in Bloomington, Voices in the Street has gone and asked whether you have been personally affected by it or whether you know someone who has.
I'm a recovering drug addict.
Me too. I know somebody who overdosed a couple of weeks ago. It's just kind of making
me
it
too.
Back around. Yeah.
Well, she died.
Yeah.
But
my
six
friend
of my friends have died this year.
Someone I know, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How so?
Overdose. One of my buddies had a couple friends that overdosed on opioids during spring break.
What's it done for you?
Personally, I mean, I just have seen some of my friends affected, and I know to just stay clear of that stuff.
I mean, I've never had an issue with it. My ex-boyfriend had to go to rehab and kind of destroyed his life from taking too many opioids. But I think that that had a lot to do with his psychiatrist at an early age prescribed him like a lot of Valium. So that led to harder and harder drugs to the point where he was on heroin. So I guess that's the only incidence that I've been affected by it.
Like, I go to school here, but we live in Michigan, and I was reading like an article by like one of the like you guy who usually writes for like IU Sports, but he was writing about how like Kirkwood right there where they're doing the construction has like gotten like bad, and he said he saw I think two overdoses in the last like week or like the last like three times he had been like on Kirkwood. Like I didn't, because I mean like you see like all the homeless people, like I'd never really like seen anything like that, which kind of surprised me.
I haven't like officially proven that. I just know that my older brother suffers from addiction pretty heavily, and he was prescribed an opiate when he was like 7 years old, and it was overprescribed to the point where he was like not functioning very well. And they took him to the doctor, and they were like, "Oh, he's overprescribed." And like years later, he ended up having huge addiction problems and doing heroin at the ages of like 14 and 16.
I know at least like one person who has gotten addicted to heavier substances because of initially being prescribed pharmaceutical like opioids. So to think that we're in a state where it's not even seen as that pressing of an issue is terrifying.
No. There's a support group that meets downstairs below my apartment. I actually don't live in Bloomington. I live up in Elkhart. And they regularly have half a dozen to a dozen people, so there's definitely a lot going on there. But personally, I'm not sure that it really has. I work for Envisage down here. We recently did a piece on the opioid epidemic, on how it's impacting public safety. So law enforcement specifically responding to incidents, and you know, there's a drug that they're having problems with, but no.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Arjun Balasundaram and Cole Stinson, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Michael Glab.
Voices in the Street was produced by Barbara Von Pervosky. Engineer today is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Ron Bronson.
And I'm Carolyn Vanderweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered independent daily news program.
If you go to iTunes, you can have this show delivered to you directly. Just go to the iTunes store, search for WFHB Daily Local News, and subscribe to our podcast.
And stay tuned for Blooming Out, Indiana's only LGBTQI public affairs show. It's coming up next here on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.